Welcome back to the Leadership and Management Book Talk Podcast. I'm Art Petty. I'm here with Wally Bach. Hey, Wally.
Hey, Art. Art, I wanted to say something.
What's that, Wally?
I wanted to admit that you were right once.
Hold it, just once?
That's all I know. Could have been other times. That's all I know.
Well, I never get tired of hearing it. I never get tired of hearing it, though.
What happened off camera here, as it were, is that we were talking and Art mentioned a time when I did say that he was right, and he's actually been right way more than that. But I just had to jump on him and see how he'd react. And you heard it here first.
Well, thank you, Wally. And by the way, I learn from you all the time, so you're mostly right, believe me. Every once in a while, we'll show by the errors of your ways, however. So, hey, we're here today, and we're going to talk about a couple of books from the oeuvre of Jim Collins. By the way, I had to look up how to pronounce that word. I certainly know the word by sight. I know what the word means, but you will chuckle, as will our 7 or 8 listeners, that I went to that site that said, how do you pronounce this, to make sure that I could say oeuvre. Because we know that I goofed up inimitable a couple of weeks ago.
We did, and that's your native language.
No kidding. All right, so we've got Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck, Why Some Thrive Despite Them All. Did I get that name right?
You did.
Okay.
That's two.
And How the Mighty Fall and Why Some Companies Never Give In. And so the first one, Great by Choice, is Collins along with Morten Hansen. I know both of you are fans of Morten Hansen's work. The second one was Jim Collins on his own.
Right.
So,
and
oh, go ahead.
Neither of these are the books that he seems to be most known for. It's not, I just blanked it. It's not Good to Great. And it's not Built to Last.
Yeah. I mean, those are the books that are still, I still have clients who, you know, in Good to Great and Built to Last, aside from the fact that the names of the companies, you know, most of them are no longer good. Those that were great aren't great anymore. And a lot of them are gone. Yet the concepts in there seem to be timeless and ageless. But there was just something fabulous about bringing out Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck at a point in time that we're living through right now, which is literally in the midst of this pandemic where no one knows where it's going. So talk about chaos. We've got a lot of it, Wally.
We do. And I think Great by Choice does a couple of things. First of all, it is the only Collins book, at least in my opinion, that is really useful for somebody who's not in a large corporation. His other books are filled, all the company examples are big. He says, for example, in the How the Mighty Fall, something about how if you have a core business that reaches a basic human need and which is your best in the world at, that will rarely go out of style or become obsolete. Well, yeah, but what if you just have a little publishing company or a pizza restaurant or a trucking outfit? At Great by Choice, it doesn't matter how big the place is. It doesn't matter whether you are at the bottom of the pyramid or some kind of middle manager or you're the CEO, you can make use of this book. And it's one of the great things about it.
Yeah, there's so many good things in there. So let's start with just his basic research premise. So a little bit of a twist from some of the other books, which focus on, you know, why are some companies great and others aren't. Specifically, he highlights, why do some companies thrive in uncertainty, even in chaos, and others do not? So the chaos component was the added research variable in there.
Yeah. I mean, some of it was the same. He was still doing comparisons.
Definitely.
And that's, I happen to like that particular style. But I think what happened is he's paired with Morten Hansen. And Morten is an academic and a very good writer himself. And I think you can see his effects in this book more than in what he does for Collins, in the way that this book is different from Collins' other books.
So what kind of impression did you get that where Hansen had his fingerprints on it?
I think the research that's outside is both broader and more cleanly sourced. I mean, there's references to other people's work and things. I think Collins' great strength is here too. He's really good at boiling a concept down to a memorable phrase or two. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you put them together and you get Hansen, who brings all this research out of his academic background. I think he's at the University of California. And Collins, who does his own kind of research, and you mash them together and you get something better than either one might do on their own.
Interesting perspective. So, you know, if you look at and read the criticism on Collins over time, there are an awful lot of people that will poke at his research. I'm not smart enough nor well-schooled, well-educated in the area of research to offer criticism. But on the other hand, I'm not looking for absolutes out of what he's giving me. I'm looking for ideas as a business professional. And, you know, at the end of this book, he actually makes the comment. He goes, look, we didn't give you the magical answers here. Good research advances understanding, but never provides the ultimate answer.
Yeah. I'm going to bring somebody else into this.
Okay.
Tom Peters, who's gotten much of the same kind of criticism. And Peters, some years ago, in a webinar that I happened to sit in on, said, you know, the kind of research we did is the kind that you do as preliminary research for a dissertation. Mm-hmm. And academics take this stuff and do more rigorous analysis of it. What we're looking for is, where do you look and what kind of insights can we get from what we've got? And I think Collins does that, and I think he does it well. My impression is that most of the people who carp on his research are academics who aren't as popular as he is.
A little bit of professional jealousy there, and wishing they had the ability to identify these catchy phrases and concepts. Yeah, you know,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm not looking for, as a strategist or in my time in corporate, I was never looking for the magical answers from him. I'm looking for ideas. I'm looking for concepts I can grab hold of. I'm always wondering how what his findings were in his research or style of research, how might they relate to what we're trying to do in our business, or what might they caution us against, and so forth. So I often think that people are taking it a little bit too seriously. There are no magical answers, and we haven't cracked the code on finding the holy grail for sustaining corporate excellence over time, forever and ever and ever.
You know what it is, Art?
What?
It's physics envy. All the social science guys want to be like physics and use lots of mathematics and prove things and conduct experiments. Well, you don't get experiments for the kind of stuff that Collins does. The closest you get is what he did, or what Peters and Waterman did back in the day. The closest you get is, look, here's what it's like in real life. Let's see. You did do a scientific study of what economic systems work well. Well, there you might have natural things. You might have, let's compare East and West Germany. Let's compare North and South Korea. Let's compare Hong Kong against Cuba. I mean, that's what's going on here. And if you want to carpet the research, great. But if you want to take the stuff that's here that's good, and there's a ton that's good, take it and don't worry so much about whether you should be wearing a tie or not when you read it.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, I love the kind of the underlying theme of this book is these companies that survive and even thrive in uncertainty and chaos, they adopt what he describes as Amundsen, the explorer Amundsen's perspective of, you don't wait until you're in an unexpected storm to discover you need more strength and endurance. You prepare with intensity all of the time. Oh my gosh, do I love that. I had the great fortune a couple of weeks ago to publish an article on SmartBrief about leading for resilience, which effectively was what I was trying to say. By the time you're into the mess, it's too hard, you know, it's you can't prepare. I think you've hit me with a saying like that before.
When they come to knock on your door, it's too late to prepare.
Yeah, there's a much darker perspective to your saying than...
Well, let's stay with Amundsen, though, for a second.
Oh, please. It's my favorite part of the book.
Well, I knew a bunch about him before from some other writing I'd done, and I thought that Collins and Hansen did a great job of presenting him and presenting him as a contrast. But in addition to the intensity of preparation, he went to the Gemba, as it were. I mean, he said, okay, who's done this long-term trek in the Arctic? Inuits. I'll go see some of them and see what they did. What did they use? They used dogs. They used horses. Okay, I'll use dogs because they used dogs and it worked. I mean, he didn't think it out. He went and said, what's kind of like the thing I'm going to do, and what are people already doing that we know works? And I'm forgetting who the guy is on the other side of this, the British explorer.
Robert Falcon Scott. So by the way, before we get too far, for the 7 out of 10 people that don't have a clue what we're talking about or who Amundsen was, Roald Amundsen was a famous explorer, and Amundsen and the Brit Robert Falcon Scott had the famous race to 90 degrees south, the race to be the first ones to arrive at the South Pole. And Wally, what you're highlighting is that Amundsen's entire life was dedicated to studying and preparing for resilience and just cultivating these different experiences. I mean, this is a guy who took a job 2,000 miles away in Europe and rode a bicycle to his job just because it would help his endurance.
Yeah, I forgot that part. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the most amazing stories or comparisons that I've read in business literature. And it's beautifully told.
Do you know what? Every time I read it, I'm both exhilarated and angry. And you know why I'm angry? Because it's such a great story in comparison, and I didn't think of it. And oh my gosh, are the parallels there between, you know, preparing for uncertainty and managing for risk and just everything you could possibly think of in the comparison contrast between what Amundsen did to prepare for that journey and what Scott did. And, you know, I think it's fascinating as well. They deal with this notion of, well, maybe Scott was just unlucky. Well, both Amundsen and Scott had luck, some good, some bad, right? Both of them were covering a little bit different because they took different routes. But Amundsen succeeded, and Scott died and his crew died 10 miles short of a food depot. You can see the parallels in this whole notion of leading for resilience and surviving and sustaining through chaos and uncertainty, and how Amundsen managed that whole process. I think it's one of the best historical comparisons in a business book I've ever seen.
I would agree. It also picks up something of what Hansen and Collins say in the book. It's kind of a central point, which is you're going to have good luck and bad luck. Mm-hmm. Everybody does. There are going to be black swans, things that you can't possibly anticipate. We can't anticipate exactly what they're going to be, but we know they're going to be there. There's going to be something. Something's going to happen.
Right.
And Art, you've got enough business experience to know that happens on almost every major project. All of a sudden you find out something that you didn't know or didn't anticipate.
Just at that moment in time when you think you've got it all nailed, life, yep, when something clubs you over the head and it's like, oh my gosh, and you've got to rethink it. Every technology project I've ever been on is like that my entire career.
There's another story from an entirely different field that relates to that. There's a movie, a Clint Eastwood movie called Heartbreak Ridge. Mm-hmm. And it's all about Clint Eastwood as a Marine gunnery sergeant and his buddies and stuff. But they did almost the entire movie before somebody realized, wait a minute, we're talking about Heartbreak Ridge in Korea. The Marines weren't at Heartbreak Ridge. Heartbreak Ridge was an Army outfit. So they had to put a scene in the movie after they'd already shot 90% of it, uh-huh, where Eastwood and another character are in a bar outside Camp Lejeune, talking about how they changed from the Army to the Marines after that. Mm-hmm. And I try to imagine what that looked like, you know, when somebody walked in and said, what are we calling this movie? you know the Marines weren't there, right?
Oops. So what's your perspective? I mean, is Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck, is that a book you would recommend, even though it's got a few years on it now, 4 or 5 years or so, I forget the exact publication date. I think I read it about 5 years ago. Is that a book you're recommending for those managing in 2020 at this point in time? Is there something they can take away from it?
Absolutely. First of all, it's got three basic core chapters that matter. There's the one we've been talking about, which is called the 20-mile march,
right?
Which refers to Amundsen's going 20 miles, a little more or a little less, but not keeping going when he felt good, or slowing down when he felt bad. You do that same thing. Then he has a chapter called Fire Bullets, Then Cannonballs,
right?
Which I think is an awful chapter, an awful title for the concept. But the concept is, do little experiments, work your way into stuff, figure out how it goes. Japanese product development versus American product development, to bring something out of your particular background. And then he talks about leading above the death line.
Death line, yeah.
You know, don't take the risks that are going to blow you away. Something I found preparing for this show was that in How the Mighty Fall, he's got a much better description of that principle, which he attributes to Bill Gore. It's called the waterline principle.
Okay.
Okay, don't do anything which is going to blow a hole in your boat below the waterline. Anything above the waterline, you can survive.
Fair bet, yeah. Yeah, no, I love the concepts. He also builds Great by Choice, or they build Great by Choice, around three core sets of behaviors, which he describes as fanatic discipline. And I think the book does a nice job describing what fanatic discipline is all about. Empirical creativity, maybe a little less tangible for me, and productive paranoia, which I liked a lot, drawing upon. Go ahead.
No, empirical creativity to me is that's experiments.
Yeah.
That's let's try this. Let's come up with a little bit instead of a lot. Let's make sure it's an above the waterline.
Let's assume something's going
trial.
To go wrong here. And oh, by the way, on our 20-mile march, if we run into really bad weather, we're still going to march 20 miles, you know? And if we run into great weather, we're still going to march 20 miles, whereas other companies would tend to go to extremes. And that goes to that fanatical discipline. It all ties together nicely. I like it a lot. And will you allow me to read from the book for a second? I want to kind of tie it off.
Feel free, Art. Read away, my friend.
So we'll see how I do here. At the end of the book, he says, the one overarching message, 6,000 years of corporate history that were included in his research study, greatness is not primarily a matter of circumstances. Greatness is first and foremost a conscious choice and discipline. The factors that determine whether or not a company becomes truly great, even in a chaotic and uncertain world, lie largely within the hands of its people. It's not mainly a matter of what happens to them, but a matter of what they create, what they do, and how well they do it. I just love that. It's a great capstone for the book.
Yeah, and it's not the, you know, you can do whatever you want to do if you're disciplined thing. It's the fact that there's a whole bunch that goes with it. It's because the other book that we're going to talk about today is How the Mighty Fall.
Yeah.
How companies that look really great, Bank of America in the 1970s, for example, turn out not to look so great a little bit later on. And some of the same themes come together, I think, which is a good thing.
Well, let's dive into How the Mighty Fall. And with your permission yet again, I'll read at least the five stages. So we'll give them.
Well, you did okay the first time, so we'll let you do another one.
So he's got, Colin suggests five different stages that companies can run through in How the Mighty Fall. Stage one, hubris born of success. Stage two, the undisciplined pursuit of more. Stage three, the peak of ascendancy and characterized by denial of risk and peril. Stage four, the precipitous decline with the organization grasping for salvation. And stage five, final capitulation to being irrelevant or accepting death. Wally, I worked in all five of those companies. Some of them I worked on my way through several stages.
I thought it was great. I like the analogy he makes to that as much as I like the particular stages. Mm-hmm. He talks about it. It's like a disease, and we've got something like that going now where you don't know that it's there, but it's already working. And he talks about cancer, but that's because he hadn't experienced COVID-19 when he was writing the book. Right. It's personally, the first two stages I've made a lot of sense to me. The others I thought were not described as well or as clearly worked out. But the hubris, oh dear, you know.
It was born of success. Yeah, that one, a little bit of success can go to the head in a hurry. And you can start to see it in the decision-making of management and the investment choices. No doubt.
Oh, yeah. I did some work when Tom Hall and I wrote Ruthless Focus. One of the companies we looked at was Chico's, mm-hmm. a women's fashion store. And it had great success as long as the founders were there. When the founders pulled back, it didn't do so well, so the founders came back. And that happened a couple of times. They finally wound up with a guy whose name was Scott Edmonds, and he got it all to work and then went through exactly what Collins describes in this book. Mm-hmm. He was sure, you know, luck had no part of it. Poor competition in certain ways had no part of it. We didn't make any choices by just, you know, blind throwing a dart at the board thing. We made all these wise choices, so it's all us. And I saw an interview with him, which I repeated in the Ruthless Focus book, where he basically says, you know, I'm not worried about the fact that we're building a new corporate headquarters. We're starting two different chains from the women's clothing thing we have in different areas, and we're going to open 400 stores in the next year because we know what we're doing. That was 3 months before things started to go bad, unwound, and he probably went from stage two, the undisciplined pursuit of more, to capitulation, to irrelevance or death. I would say in about 6 to 7 months before somebody came in and took over the job.
That was one fast slide. Woof.
Yes, it was even faster than pets.com.
So you know what, in my experience, I mean, the hubris born of success, that one's kind of visible all over the place, but stage two is the one that organizations need some canary mm-hmm. in the coal mine type of warning signal. Undisciplined pursuit of more. And what I relate that to are all the environments that I find where there are too many projects chasing too few resources. Because everything in isolation seems like a good idea, which tells me there's lack of a clear strategy. They don't have the ability to say what not to do. And you get into this just gross dilution of the organization's energies and resources. That one I see people falling into over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I don't know anybody else who put it the way he did, and the way he did is excellent. But yeah, how many times do we see, they use Circuit City as one of the examples in the book, and they come up with a couple of different ideas, one of which is the used car operation that they set up in a...
Yeah, I don't
remember. I'll remember it. Art will put it in the show notes.
That's right. Yeah.
And he says, you know, it wasn't that it was a bad idea. It was that there were too many good ideas. I think it's probably Steve Jobs who said, the art of success is saying no to good ideas.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's Jobs, but it's a great, great point. So what I had noticed in my own career was this stage three, peak of ascendancy, characterized by denial of risk and peril, you know, that's where that organization, and I lived through it, an organization in a market that by all reasonable measures was dead and dying, it might take a decade or more for that market to shrink. And you can still make money in a shrinking market if you're good. But this culture of the company puts so much pride in their success in that particular marketplace that they didn't take the time to invest and diversify and find a way out of it. And so their fortunes declined along with the, you know, inevitable decline of the market. And just couldn't see it. So
I think something else, a friend of mine who I won't name because he hasn't given me permission, said that the most important thing you can do when you're a CEO, and he was a CEO of several companies and successful at all of them, mm-hmm. was you have to find the truth tellers. And you need people who will walk into your office and say, Art, I know we've been successful before, but this is a really stupid idea, and here's why. Mm-hmm. And they've got to be, something else he said, people you will listen to. Mm-hmm. They can't just be the guy who's the pain that we always hear from. They've got to be people who are credible to you, but who will tell you what you need to hear instead of what you'd like to hear.
Well said. And what this phase always reminds me of is that saying that culture eats strategy for lunch. So in this particular...
Or breakfast, depending on who's quoting it.
Yeah, well, in this particular case, my perspective was, you know, sometimes strategy needs to eat culture for dinner. And it really needed to do that. By the way, you can quote me on that, Wally.
I'm writing it down as we speak, Art. That's three.
Fortunately, I've never had the privilege of being in a company involved in stage five, but I've certainly maneuvered. We actually took that stage three company and brought it back to a very successful market leader in a completely new space. So that was where strategy had to eat culture for lunch. There was nothing easy about it, but it ultimately did.
Yeah, and I think one of the key messages of the book is that this is not inevitable stuff.
Mm-hmm, right.
This is not, you have the hubris, you do the undisciplined pursuit of more, you deny risk, and you can never come back. Mm-hmm. Because people come back, companies come back. And that's as important as anything else in the book. It's like, unless you're already, you know, they're putting the toe tag on you, putting you in the body bag.
Well, one of the points I grasped too from the book, though, was that it's okay for companies to die. Sometimes they, and you know, you get into the whole creative destruction and what have you perspective there. I've gotten into interesting debates with people before. I don't think that companies have to die, yet some companies will because they don't find the wherewithal to pivot, to move to somewhere else. And, you know, it's just their DNA doesn't allow it. A lot of reasons. They're a big debate. But what do you think about that? I mean, is it okay for some companies to die? Because we're certainly seeing it right now in our market.
Well, and we will. And yes, it's okay. In fact, I think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of capitalism, and I think one of the things about if you're going to have capitalism, companies have to die. That's the way it is. But you can take another story, and it's one that he alludes to in this book. You can look at a company like Nucor. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nucor started out as a car company, mm-hmm. and then moved to trucks, the REO Speedwagon, not the group, but the actual car. And then they got to the 50s, and they were trying to find something cool to do, and nuclear was really cool. It was kind of like the neuroscience of its day. So they became the Nuclear Corporation of America with like 17 divisions, 16 of which were not making money. So they bought a steel company in Florence, South Carolina, where my brother-in-law happens to live. And they sent Ken Iverson out from Phoenix to go there because they figured he could be sacrificed. They didn't want to sacrifice themselves. And he turned it into something really cool. And he turned it into what we know as Nucor, which still stands for Nuclear Corporation. Okay, but is one of the most innovative and profitable steel companies in the world. And even with that, there's a bit of a cycle that you can see. Sure. They've gone into people like Chaparral Steel, copied some of their technology. That wasn't so good. They discovered stuff by accident. It's a great company, but it's not a great company that was always successful.
So, Wally?
Yes, Art.
Thank you. I'm still trying to figure out how REO Speedwagon fits into this.
the company that became the Nuclear Corporation of America, was originally Ransom E. Olds, which became REO, and they made a car that became the Oldsmobile. But the owner, the Ransom guy, went on and had to make something else, so he made a truck called REO Speedwagon.
Aha. And where did the band come in?
I have no idea.
And what city does the band come from?
I have no idea. Probably Chicago, if you're asking me.
No, Champaign, Illinois, the home of the University of Illinois.
Oh, got it.
Just thought I'd throw that in there. So, no, great examples. Let me ask you your perspective. If you were to recommend, with the limited time that so many have in this world today, one of these two reads, which one would you recommend?
Oh, there's no question. It would be Great by Choice. I think Great by Choice is a great business book. One of the great business books I've read.
Right and there with you. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, ditto on that. I don't think I would actually advise people to read How the Mighty Fall unless you just love Jim Collins' work.
Yeah. And Jim Collins' work is, I mean, he writes well enough and interestingly enough that you might want to do that. My recommendation would be, unless you really love Jim Collins and you really want to see what this is, buy a summary from Soundview or somebody, or business summaries, and see what you get.
I think I need to ring a bell when you describe a product. Ding. Okay, they're not a sponsor on the show, but maybe they should be.
Maybe they should be. Yes.
So, bring us home here, Wally. Bring us home, and then I've got kind of a follow-on comment that comes out of Great by Choice. A short section that I want to highlight because I think it's a point worth kind of leading off on.
Okay, and I'll say that I remember the thing that Circuit City did. It's CarMax.
Ah, okay. By the way, Circuit City was a good to great company, and it's a gone company now. And
the good to great to gone, yeah.
Yeah, good to great to gone. Zoom, and it was a fast, precipitous decline. And of course, the remnant that everybody expected to follow them was Best Buy. And you know what? They've kind of navigated the chasm here, so to speak.
Yes, I'm speaking to you using a computer I bought at Best Buy. In the other room is a refrigerator I bought at Best Buy.
There you go, yeah.
And I just recommended Best Buy to someone else.
Yep, with the ding once again. Are they a sponsor?
No. What I would say, though, to Collins' credit, is Collins wrote about Circuit City in How the Mighty Fall,
right,
even though it had been one of the companies in Good to Great. Mm-hmm. So... okay, my summary, Great by Choice is a great business book. It's worth your time. It's worth buying. Yeah, it's a little old today. How the Mighty Fall, the basic outline is pretty good, but the book itself is not nearly as good as some of the stuff you can get from Amazon with a couple of clicks.
Not as useful. Yep. I completely agree with you. In a rare moment, in a fit of insanity, I totally agree with you, Wally. And what I'd like to leave everybody with is a thought from Great by Choice, where Collins says, and Collins and Hansen say, the greatest leaders we've studied throughout all our research cared as much about values as victory, as much about purpose as profit, as much about being useful as being successful. Their drive and standards are ultimately internal, rising from somewhere deep inside. And I love that perspective for anyone leading and navigating through the chaos and turmoil of today's world.
Amen.
On that note, it was great talking with you again, Wally. We'll catch you next time. Take care.
All right. Take care, Art.